Biggest data leak in history. Welcome to KUOW's The Record and the Panama Papers. I'm Bill Radke. More than 11 million files reveal how the rich and powerful secret their money away in offshore accounts. Maybe they just want privacy. Maybe they're dodging taxes. Maybe they're hiding crimes. Yesterday, the Prime Minister of Iceland stepped down after the documents suggested he's been hiding millions in assets. How did the Panama Papers story break? Bainbridge Island resident Bill Buesenberg was involved at the start. He's the former vice president of news for National Public Radio and former head of the Center for Public Integrity, which ran the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that broke this giant story. Buesenberg told me how the 400 journalists of the ICIJ pulled off the biggest media collaboration in history.
I call these people the Jedi Knights of the investigative journalism world. They're the best people everywhere you could work. In England, it's The Guardian, and The Guardian assigned four reporters to this. In France, it's Le Monde. They work with ICIJ, the international consortium, to dig into it for the names of people in their countries, and then they share that information with all of the other journalists. In this latest case of the Panama Papers, it's about 400 journalists working together around the world.
Why does the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists exist?
It was built 15 years ago to do just this kind of cross-border work. This is a global world. There is no media organization singly that I think can tackle the things that are working cross-border so much. And ICIJ was created to do that in a way that's, you know, affordable, because you can't hire 400 journalists for a year to work on a single project. But with The Guardian paying their reporters and Le Monde paying their reporters, you can do this kind of work on a collaborative basis. And that's what ICIJ was set up to do.
What was the hardest part about breaking this story?
Well, the data is big, unstructured data. We're talking about 11.5 million files. Just imagine going through 4 million emails. This is a massive 2.6 terabytes or something like that. The computer programmers break it down country by country, and they give that data to the reporters in that country, and then they start digging on it and sharing that information, as I said. But it's very difficult data to work with, and it took a long time. That's why this was really working more than a year, some say 2 years, from when they started the data and got it and started spreading it out. But I think working with the data, and then you have to go and ask the people who are named to respond. That's why Vladimir Putin started condemning the international attack on him a week ago, because his office was asked to respond because of all the data they found of the $2 billion that he and his friends had squirreled away in a secret account. And that was in the data. But we got a response from everybody, or a no response from everybody. And that's the time-consuming part of this investigation.
So it's a remarkable global journalistic collaboration. What's the most important thing that's going to come of it?
Well, I think the impact is in the transparency that this creates. We're already seeing fewer offshore accounts. People set up those accounts and they were told these will be secret forever. You never have to worry about it. Well, ICIJ has been digging into these now. The last four big projects have released massive amounts of data of offshore previously secret accounts. When that becomes public, people are now understanding how it works. There's public outrage. That stiffens the spine of governments to start sharing the data and trying to close these loopholes. A lot of this is legal, that it was set up that way, but of course it allows bribery and arms deals and tax evasion and financial fraud and drug trafficking to occur because it's secret. So governments now, I think, are on notice that they need to take more action to prevent this. And that's the biggest result of having, you know, 100 media organizations publish something in a 24-hour period. It has a big impact that governments are going to be dealing with for quite a while. I think you'll see more resignations. There will be more. There'll be more arrests eventually. There'll be more things coming out of this. And that, I think, contributes to the fact that it's a new world with this kind of data disclosure.
Will Americans go to jail?
Well, the president spoke about this yesterday, about closing loopholes, but there aren't a lot of American names in here. It's pretty easy to set up a secret account in the United States, in fact.
We already let you do that.
Yeah.
It's called Nevada. It's called...
Right. You don't have to go through Panama to do it. So you don't find a lot of Americans in here yet. There are some, and there will be some other disclosures coming out down the road. But, you know, I don't know that this is going to change everything in the United States, but I think our collaboration... Our government collaboration, the Justice Department work with other countries, really is changing. And there have been now new laws, certainly in Europe and in the way that we share data, and that if you have a bank account in another country, that bank is sending that information to the U.S. government and the U.S. Treasury. So it's making the tax evasion that comes out of this, I think, harder little by little.
We're talking with Bill Buesenberg, former head of the Center for Public Integrity, of which a part was the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that broke this gigantic story. Why is it important for journalistic collaborations like this one to exist?
You know, I love this project. I love the way it worked because nobody can do this kind of thing. No single, not even the New York Times or anybody can take on this kind of a big project this way and work all over the world at the same time with so much data. So I think ICIJ, as it's called, the International Consortium, is needed to do that work in the global world that now exists. Investigative journalism is something I believe in. It's important. Disclosure, transparency, accountability, this is important work being done responsibly. And I feel like this is real journalism went on for a very long time, and the reporters kept it secret themselves until they agreed upon date when it could all be published. And they knew then that the impact would be much bigger when it came out all at once.
Will global journalism lead to global transparency?
Well, we're in that world. I hope so. This is like chipping away at the secrecy that exists that allows all this nefarious stuff to go on. So this is chipping away at it. You know, this is just one law firm in Panama that had this much data going back 40 years. There are hundreds and hundreds of others. So this is not, you know, going to disclose everything, but I think it puts a lot of secret account holders on notice that there's not going to be secrecy forever for what they've done.
Bill Buesenberg headed up the Center for Public Integrity. That's the group that runs the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that broke the Panama Papers story. Bill Buesenberg lives on Bainbridge Island now, and he is the editor of KUOW's Elections Project. The U.S. Justice Department says it's reviewing these so-called Panama Papers for evidence of corruption or violations of American law. President Obama says the massive document leak is evidence that world leaders should do more to crack down on individuals and corporations that try to dodge taxes. This is KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. In this month of April, we're looking into some taxing matters in the Pacific Northwest. Washington and Oregon are two of America's oddest tax neighbors. More than 40 states use sales and income taxes to pay for government, but not Washington and Oregon. We like to do it all with one hand tied behind our back. Washington, no income tax. Oregon, no sales tax. KUOW's economy reporter Carolyn Adolf went to Portland to find out how our rivalry is going.
We've all done it. A cash register in downtown Portland, and in my case, new yoga pants.
There you go.
Woohoo! Just a little casual sales tax evasion among friends. Oregon is the land of freedom from sales tax, and just a drive away. Washington is the land of freedom from state income tax, which Oregonians cannot experience unless they move. Looks like the people of Washington are winning. However, an unofficial calculation prepared by Washington's Department of Revenue indicates that the state is not. It says that if Washington State had Oregon's tax system, Washington would be $9.5 billion richer, almost double the revenue from taxes. This news does not come as a shock in the Oregon state capital, Salem. Paul Warner is the state's revenue officer. Watching Washington State is part of his job.
We would have to have a 12% sales tax in Oregon to collect the amount of revenue we collect from our personal income tax.
A 12% sales tax would be almost double Washington State's sales tax. And Oregon is not going to do that. Warner has noticed something else about Washington State.
Over time, the sales tax base has declined relative to the economy.
This has been going on for 20 years. Washington's sales tax revenues have been shrinking compared to the size of our economy. So, the economy adds jobs and wealth, and sales tax revenues grow too, but only a little. This is one of the perils of running a state on a sales tax, because people's spending habits have changed. They buy more on the internet, and they pay less state sales tax.
That gap just gets bigger and bigger every year.
This is James McIntyre, Washington State Treasurer, who has been staring at our shrinking pile of revenue for years. If it wasn't for our eroding tax base,
we'd have another $15 billion in the state treasury to be used for education and health care and other social services.
Washington's economic growth means, among other things, more people. The state has 100,000 more school-age children to educate than it did in 1995.
If you're going to sustain education, you just can't do it. It's mathematically impossible to sustain it on a shrinking tax base.
Oregon doesn't face this problem, but it has a serious problem of its own. Mark McMullen, Oregon's state economist.
We do get larger swings here during the recessions.
Meaning, when lots of Oregonians lose jobs, the state loses lots of tax revenue. Just when people need government, government is laying people off and making things worse. Mark McMullen.
It's sort of, unfortunately, it's par for the course.
This is one of the perils of running a state on an income tax. In the last recession, Oregon lost more than a tenth of its revenue because people were unemployed. Mark McMullen says people in the capital are still haunted by what happened next.
Pretty painful time for them.
Oregon started cutting school days.
This is Tom Potowski. He's an economics professor at Portland State University. Teachers were laid off, and small towns lost their law enforcement.
I mean, these are serious problems.
So Oregon is looking for a way to make its tax system provide more revenue in the hard times. And it has noticed that Washington State actually has something Oregon might want. Washington's business and occupations tax. It's a percentage of everything a business sells, and the revenue it generates is pretty resilient in a recession. Tom Potowski.
There are people out there thinking about it. States trying to figure out what other forms of revenue are there, and also wanting to have revenue sources that tend to be a little more stable.
But Oregon still has no interest in a state sales tax. That is Washington's thing. I'm Carolyn Adolph in Portland, Oregon.
This story was produced in partnership with the Ravitch Fiscal Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Hey, Seattleites, would you like to see how your tax burden compares to other American cities? We're tweeting a link to an interactive graph. So join us right now on Twitter, at KUOW. If you are a renter in Seattle's boiling hot housing market, you probably don't want to hear that your building has just been sold to a new owner. Across the city, developers are buying apartment buildings, fixing them up, and then raising the rent, sometimes more than doubling the rent, like what happened to residents of one apartment building in West Seattle. The city council member from West Seattle, Lisa Herbold, has an idea. Have the city buy those buildings, keep them affordable, and make developers pay for it. Lisa Herbold, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
The mayor has a whole affordable housing plan in the works. What's missing that you're trying to fix here?
Well, the missing piece of the overall affordable housing strategy is specifically preservation. It is true that we had legislation before the state legislature this year to try to deal with some of the needs to maintain existing affordable housing, but that legislation did not pass. And so rather than waiting for the next session, I'm trying to key up some tools that the city could use now, basically to pilot a program where the city wouldn't buy the building, but that the city would help support a nonprofit housing provider buy the building. And the housing levy is one of our fantastic tools for affordable housing, but again, it's not focused on preservation. It's really focused on development of new housing. And the issue that we struggle with, and one of the issues that came up really strongly in the HALA process, is this idea that our affordable housing strategy needs to be about preventing displacement of existing communities. And in order for us to be economically and racially diverse as a city, one of our big strengths as a city, we must first and foremost help existing communities prosper in place.
Okay, the city helps a nonprofit housing provider buy buildings, and how would you pay for that?
The city does currently through the housing levy. This would just be a new funding source, and it would be, again, the idea is about creating a program that is not having projects compete with our existing housing funds, our levy funds, but that we have a different program that prioritizes preservation rather than requiring preservation projects to compete for housing levy dollars. And so basically the idea is that the city would issue a small housing bond that would then serve as financing to assist a nonprofit developer to purchase a building, and that would typically also help basically implement the notice to sell multifamily housing ordinance that was passed last year. So currently we have a new law on the books that says that when a building is up for sale, they have to notify the city's Office of Housing, and then the Office of Housing has to notify nonprofit developers. And so this would allow these nonprofit developers to spring into action and make an offer on those buildings that's competitive.
You want a tax on developers, so not a new tax to voters or a new property tax, a tax on developers, which wouldn't developers pass that on to the rest of us in higher prices?
Developers. This is an increment of the existing taxes associated with new construction. So this is money that's already going into the general fund currently. This is the new construction tax. That might sound confusing. It might sound like I'm talking about a new tax, but it is the tax associated with new construction property taxes that are already going into the general fund. It's only the gross. So it's only the new dollars that are going into the general fund, and it would be a sliver of that.
Why stop at buying up apartments? Why not raise money to buy vacant buildings and turn those into affordable housing or build more housing outright?
Well, we are going to be building more housing, and we do build purchase vacant buildings as well. The past housing levy did both of those things. There are, I think, two buildings that were purchased that were vacant buildings. Again, the issue with this is a strategy that is really focused on making sure that people who live in these buildings are not displaced. One of the examples that we discussed today was the Panorama. It was a building in First Hill that got a lot of attention when new owners purchased that building, and rents went from about $1,200 a month, and they're now $3,000 a month.
You know, I haven't heard the words rent control in a while. Is that debate over?
That's really a debate that is one that has to be focused at the state legislature. The council last year, before the beginning of the legislative session, did pass a resolution asking the state legislature to look at forms of rent regulation, including rent control. But there was one bill in the state legislature that looked at requiring more notice for large rent increases. So that is in one form of rent control. When people talk about rent control, they rarely are talking about the same thing. But any rent regulation is really a form of rent control. But that bill did not pass.
Looking at a way to maintain existing affordable housing in Seattle, that's Lisa Herbold, who represents West Seattle on the City Council. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW's The Record at 12:28. I'm Bill Radke. You've heard somebody say it. If Trump wins, I'm moving to Canada. Well, that's not the only reason to go, says Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Apparently, the price of a Canadian education these days is attracting some American students.
This sort of happens every time the Canadian dollar is down, which it is at the moment. Canadian university fees start looking pretty attractive to Americans that are looking at what it costs to go to a big American university.
Yes, I understand the University of British Columbia paid a little recruiting visit to Seattle.
Yeah, our universities go south and recruit. One of the big selling points they have is the fees are a lot lower. You can get into UBC for a fraction of what it costs to go to American university. There's a special discount available if you happen to have dual citizenship, which some Americans do. Some of them repudiate it. Ted Cruz did, but mm-hmm. if you have dual citizenship, you can get in. A lot of Canadian universities now do charge more for foreign students, and they make a fair amount of money off of it. So that's one of the things they're pitching as well. But, you know, it depends on the university. People should look at the website to see what the real dollar figures are. But yes, generally, Canadian universities are a little more heavily subsidized by the government, and the tuition fees tend to be a bit lower.
Any other advantages for an American to getting a Canadian education?
Well, most of the Canadian universities have a pretty good reputation. If you go to McGill University in Montreal, which has a pretty good international reputation, you can also pick up the French language living in Montreal, one of the world's great exciting cities. So I don't want to sound too disloyal to British Columbia, but that's a pretty neat place to go as well. A lot of people go to the University of Toronto. The universities on the prairies, particularly the ones in Alberta, have pretty high quality faculty because they pay very well. So people do shop around now. Of course, you know, there are disadvantages too. A little harder for Americans to get the kind of scholarships that are available at American universities. So for a lot of Americans, this tends to be second choice. You mentioned too off the top, Bill, this happens periodically with American elections. You will see coverage in the Canadian news media suggesting, well, if so-and-so wins the election, Americans are going to move to Canada, and there's some American law firms that specialize in helping you to do that. It doesn't actually tend to happen. If people could remember the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was going to win, there were Americans that talked about it as well. The only really major influx of Americans to Canada in modern times, and it was significant, were people avoiding the draft during the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of people live in British Columbia still and other Canadian provinces who came here and made their lives here because they didn't want to go to Vietnam.
I remember one reason to move to Canada was if you were a serious hockey player. We've got troubled times
no.
up there.
Oh, you got to bring that up,
sorry,
do you? Okay.
Sorry.
So, yes, the shame of it all. For the first time in, what, 40, 45 years, there are no Canadian teams in the Stanley Cup playoffs. All seven Canadian teams bombed out this year. All seven Canadian teams are at the bottom of the league. And so Canadians are sort of going, well, who am I going to cheer for this year? Happily, there are a lot of Canadians who play for American hockey teams. So Canadians have a range of choices. But yes, it is embarrassing that the seven teams from the country that is supposedly the world hockey king, we did win the Olympics, are not in the league, not in the playoffs, and the three teams in California and both teams in Florida are in the playoffs.
That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. This is KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow is Seattle's monthly First Thursday Art Walk, when galleries all over town are open to the public free of charge. How do you decide where to go, what to see? The Strangers art critic, Jen Graves, visited us here for a little art walk pregame, and I figured she would tell you where to see some art, and instead she recommended you go see some places that may not be around for much longer.
The New Foundation, which is the project of philanthropist Sherry Benke in Pioneer Square. Pivot Art and Culture, which is Paul Allen's project at the Brain Institute on Westlake, and not sure whether that's shutting down or not. No word about what's exactly happening.
We don't know.
Platform Gallery, definitely shutting down in Pioneer Square. It's a commercial gallery run by Stephen Lyons. He's been in business 12 years, and he's going to take it online.
Let's start with New Foundation, Pioneer Square. What's going on there?
Well, the Foundation announced earlier last year, at the end of last year, that they were going to do a big project called Housing is a Human Right, which would be exhibitions, workshops, presentations, talks with a lot of partner organizations, too, including the library and all that stuff, to talk about housing crisis, displacement, homelessness, all kinds of things through the work of the artist Martha Rosler, who's from Brooklyn and is very an important American artist. Gave her $100,000 and something called the 100K Prize, and they began those programs in January. Last week, suddenly announced they're shutting everything down. Sherry Behnke announced she's shutting everything down. Not any warning. Not sure exactly what led up to the way it happened, but the reason that she's giving is family illness.
So if I go to the Martha Rosler show first Thursday, give me some idea what I'll see.
What you will see is the exhibition, the second exhibition in the series, which is called Homeless, the Street and Other Venues. And it's a series of documentations, archival information about the show that she did in 1989 regarding homelessness in New York. And then it's updated for Seattle with a lot of information about here and kind of calls to action in a way, implied calls to action about things to do about what's happening here right now.
Okay, so if I'm going to the Art Walk, I should go see Martha Rosler's show if you lived here at the New Foundation. You mentioned two other places that are maybe on the verge of closure at least. Those are,
Pivot.
Let's start with Paul Allen, Pivot.
Yeah, Pivot, we're not sure whether it's going to be an occasional gallery space and what occasional gallery space means. Essentially, if you ask Vulcan, they say, we're not sure about the future. That's sort of the end of the answer. But for now, there's one exhibition at least on the docket, and that is opening this week, and it's called Imagine Futures, and it's art that has to do with space and space travel.
It got a lot of attention when Paul Allen said he's going to open up this modern contemporary art and culture space. Were people not going to it? What happened?
Didn't have a chance to find out. Opened in December, and shortly after that, the staff members started receiving word that they weren't working there anymore on a full-time basis. And I think only one of them is left on sort of a project basis, as far as I know. But it's also very hard to get information out of Vulcan, so I'm not sure.
I guess that's life in a tech startup culture.
Or Vulcan.
And now let's talk about the Art Space in Pioneer Square platform.
Mm. That space has been running for 12 years. It's a traditional gallery, art gallery, where art is for sale, not run by a philanthropist, but run by somebody who's trying to make ends meet every month. And he is taking his artists online. He shows contemporary work, and there are three shows left there.
Taking them online, what do you think of that?
A lot of galleries have been closing down and taking their artists online, closing their physical spaces, and I'm not really sure how effective that is for the artists, but I know for audiences, obviously, it's a huge disappointment. We don't get to see the work anymore.
Jen, you know, this is Jen Graves from The Stranger, and you know more about the Seattle art scene than probably anybody listening to us now. I want to know what it means to you that these places are or might be shutting down.
Well, I think we talk about the precariat, workers in the economy who have sort of share jobs. And I think it just points to that artists have always been the precariat, and they still really, really are. And there are various economies at work in art. There's philanthropy, there's the commercial market, which often, you know, sounds like an exchange of money, but really means that things are for sale but don't sell in Seattle. And so I think it's just kind of looking at how precarious funding models are, and we have to really start talking about when wealthy people step forward with ideas, what is the sustainability of those ideas, and what is the plan? Because not with Platform Gallery, but with Pivot potentially, and certainly with the New Foundation, like those projects are it's wonderful when philanthropists get involved, and also what are the future of those projects? They have sort of had a shelf life here that's quite short.
That's a little bit of a bleak update from the Art Walk. Bigger picture in the future, do you despair or don't despair? You think for artists who want to show work in Seattle?
I never despair.
Never
despair.
What a wonderful quality. How do you pull that off?
Well, I complain a lot, but and diagnose a lot, but don't despair, I guess. So But there is a very sort of warm and wonderful show of photographs at Platform to close this moment, if you want to, where it's Adam Ekberg's photographs, and he takes these sort of plain moments in the universe and the world and turns them into photographical sort of magic. I don't know whether photographical is even a word that I would use in writing, but but it's these sort of bright little moments in photographs, and they only exist in the photographs. So they're these sort of sweet, magical little objects. And the work is really the reason why I don't despair, why I never despair. Artists keep making it. They're always going to keep making it. And it's very, very good work.
Stranger, art critic Jen Graves recommending you go to three galleries that might be closing soon. The New Foundation and Platform Galleries are in Pioneer Square. Pivot Art and Culture is in South Lake Union. And you can find out more about this month's Art Walk when you visit pioneersquare.org. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Last night, hundreds of University of Washington students marched from the campus's Intellectual House to Red Square and then into a forum called Power and Privilege in Everyday Life. It was a university-run discussion about equity. University of Washington senior Palka Shabale was one of the students who interrupted the forum. She says there's been enough talk about race and equity at the UW. It's time for the university to act on creating a more equitable campus.
We had a list of several demands. The most comprehensive list of demands were given last year by a multitude of schools. One includes increasing faculty of color, creating pipeline programs from elementary to high school to college level that focuses on predominantly black and brown schools, which are socioeconomically disadvantaged. It includes divesting from prisons. It includes ceasing harassment, racial and sexual harassment of workers of color, predominantly black and Latinos at the University of Washington. It includes addressing the very ingrained history of sexual assault, particularly in the Greek community, that we don't see. So there's a lot of demands, and I could talk about them for quite a while, and these demands are public.
Palka, you are a senior at the University of Washington. You won't be there forever, but the university itself has to think long-term, and it's a giant ship. You're talking about systemic change. Why would that happen fast? I'm looking at a 25 increase of faculty of color by winter 2017. Why should the university move on your timetable?
So we gave the university a timetable because the university is not moving at all. If we look at the history of this country and if we look at the type of systemic change that's actually occurred, any sort of radical systemic change that has occurred through by student activist push, which is why we even have a recent equity initiative with people, which people said, you know, that wouldn't happen, right? Student activists got on the road, right? We protested, and within months after, CASE launched a recent equity initiative. So what the university does, and this is very tactical, is that they wait people out. So I am a student and I am a senior, but the issues that I've been fighting for, if you look back through the history of activism back in the 60s, back in the 50s, you see the same issues and the same type of plight that people back then were fighting for. So these are not new issues, right? So when we talk about racism, when you talk about police brutality, these have always existed. But we want the university to get to a place where they just don't talk the talk, they actually walk the walk.
The university says what it's doing is assessing the climate for students, promoting transparent communication so students can report incidents of bias, and they're working on training and development for staff and faculty. That's not a plan to you?
So the first thing they're doing is assessing the climate, but the climate has already been assessed, right? So we already know that these issues exist. So when I hear things like we're assessing the climate, when the University of Washington has had multiple upon multiple protests about the same issues, not just from now, but back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way until now, why do you need to assess a climate that is very obvious? It's a very aggressive climate. In terms of promoting transparent communications, what is that going to do for racial equity? And it's just when the university releases this very vague, we will promote transparent communications to the staff or to the public, that's not an action plan. That what type of transparent communications are you doing? How is that going to have any structural impact? what does promoting transparent communication even do? When it comes to the third point, when we talk about training and development for staff and faculty, it's also important to understand that when we talk about issues of race, it's much more than going to a cultural sensitivity meeting and saying, oh, I went to this cultural sensitivity meeting and here I'm checking that box and now I'm okay, right? There needs to be a lot more structure to it. What the university is doing right now is that they're putting a Band-Aid on a broken brick.
How has the university reached out to you and other students to talk about the changes you want?
The talks are always occurring. What is frustrating is that there's just a lot of talk and not a lot of action. And so when I've talked to administrators, it's always goes something like, we support you and we hear your voice. We hear you students and we want you to know that we are committed truly to racial equity. But that's kind of where it ends. When the university is pushed on actual action, like, will you address UWPD police brutality in this way? The answer is always no. We can't do that. What will you do to make sure that we've got increasing enrollment of students of color, particularly black students, at the university? It's no, we will not do that. We don't have money for X, Y, and Z. We can't do this. So it's always roadblocks that are put ahead of us, and it's roadblocks that are put ahead of to the path of equity. So when we say we want you to address this issue in this way and that's what it's equitable, the university says no, but then comes out and says, yes, we are a university that's dedicated towards equity. So it's a lot of talk, it's a lot of window dressing, and we are fatigued. There's a lot of fatigue among students on all the window dressing that's going on. We are ready for action, and we want the university to actually live up to their mission statement, which actually has diversity on it, and not just use it sort of to paint the university as a very welcoming area, and not to paint the university as an institution that is committed to equity without actually being committed to equity. I think a good friend of mine said, we don't want diversity, we want decolonization and we want anti-racism. We want an anti-racist UW.
You're a University of Washington senior. What do you do about changes on campus after you graduate, Bianca?
There will be people who will keep up this work long after I'm gone. Campus activism or of any sort is a lifestyle. So long after I'm gone, and even before I walked onto campus, there were people who carried on the work before me. This is something that I will continue to be dedicated to. There will come a time where I will have to step down and let fresh new voices, younger voices, take the center stage for this. But it's not something that I'm worried will dissipate. I see this sort of as a continuing struggle at the University of Washington between students and between administrators and in between all sorts of oppressive systems that are in between and holding us down socioeconomically, but also on a very racial level. And so I'm hoping that all these rallies that we're having and all these protests that we're having actually inspires faculty, students, other workers, community members of all races, of all colors to come together and really speak out.
Bianca Shabale is a University of Washington senior studying molecular biology. We also talked with her late last year about why she thinks the UW is not a safe space for students of color. We're tweeting out a link to that interview right now. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. Tomorrow, we will talk with the University of Washington's Dean of Undergraduate Academic Affairs about how the university plans to address students' concerns about race and equity on campus. Did you miss any of the last hour on KUOW? Not a problem. Get our podcasts of this and other KUOW shows on your favorite podcast app or go to KUOW.org like engineer Bernard Ouellette does or producer Jason Pagano. If they can do it, you can do it. You can also go to Twitter at KUOW. That's where we're live tweeting the show. Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.